This is the tape of the first lecture of ancient Israel. In this particular lecture, I just want to cover a few points. First of all, the purpose of the class. Why do we feel it's necessary to have a class in this subject matter when, at least for the students here at the college, you presumably, or almost all of you, or all of you have had a class in Old Testament survey? And the answer to that is that, just as the name implies, Old Testament survey, you have surveyed a vast body of information without being allowed to get into a lot of depth in very much of it. Now, that doesn't mean that we're going to cover the entire Old Testament in depth, so you could never go any deeper, but we're going to try to do some excavations in a number of critical and interesting areas of the Bible, so that we can better understand how God worked with his people, beginning with the patriarch Abraham that he called out of his own society, all the way through the time that the kingdom of Judah was carried into captivity in Babylon. Now, in approaching this class, I have two fundamental purposes in accomplishing that overall purpose. And that is, one, to understand more fully what is written in the Bible. To understand more fully what is written in the Bible. Now, I'm not insulting your intelligence. I'm not saying that when you read a passage, you don't understand the vocabulary and therefore you're missing something of importance. But you have to remember, as a very noted scholar said at a conference I attended last spring, and he said it quite accurately, he said, the Bible is not an English book. We have access to it in English, but it is not an English book. The Old Testament is a book written in Hebrew and Aramaic, primarily Hebrew with some Aramaic sections. Each language employs idioms that are unique to that language and that are very difficult to translate accurately out of that language. And so when you work with a book in translation, you inevitably lose something. But the problem is even more difficult, as that scholar noted. He said the Bible is not a 20th century book. It is a book written about life as it was lived over many centuries, all of them very far removed from us. The Bible is not a 20th century book. The world it pictures is the world of, well, starting with Abraham, from approximately 2000 B.C. to 586 B.C. when we, at least in this semester, will cease our work with the captivity of Judah. It's describing social institutions, legal institutions, that are very different from the ones we have today. But when the book was written, it was written to people who understood those institutions, who didn't need elaborate explanations of what these institutions meant. To give you an example of a 20th century, well, not so much a 20th century institution alone, it's older than just this century, but one that exists in our century. If somebody was writing a novel and they wanted to write about two people that met and then had a conversation, they might say that Mr. Green entered the room. When he saw Mr. Brown, he approached, shook hands, and then began to ask him, and the rest continues. But if you had lived in a completely different culture thousands of years ago, where nobody shook hands upon meeting, the person might have scratched their heads if they had read that and said, what's shaking hands? How do you shake hands? What do you do with your hands that when you shake? And what's the purpose? What did that mean? Was that a sign of hostility? Was that a sign of peace? Was that a, what was its purpose? You see, they'd be totally confused, not understanding what this meant. But we wouldn't think it necessary if we were writing that novel today to explain what shaking hands was like and how you did it and what it meant, because we all understand that. Now we have the reverse problem. We read about their ways of doing things without explanation, and sometimes they're very different in our day. For example, one of the things we shall discuss fairly early on is the matter of Sarah providing her handmaid Hagar to Abraham. And I think this is something which is, by and large, misunderstood by most people in our culture, including most people in the church. And we will try to get into that and see it in the light of what it meant in her day and age. Now, as I mentioned earlier, we have the problem of dealing with the Bible in translation. But not just in translation, we're dealing in the main with a translation that was done into English in the 17th century, 1603, or thereabout. No, 1620s, I guess, is when the King James was done, wasn't it? I don't have the front of the Bible to see. 1611, okay. Early 17th century. Words change their meaning. For example, in the King James Version, in one of the passages, it talks about a creek. Now, what is a creek, or some would say a crick today? What is a creek?
Small stream.
Small stream. But in the King James English, it didn't mean a small stream. A creek was a harbor or bay. A creek was a harbor or bay. That's a little different than a small stream, you see. There's more than just a subtlety there. It can mean a whole lot of difference depending on where the usage appears. Or in the New Testament, a word that appears not infrequently in the King James English is the word anon. I will do that anon. Or anon, I will do that. Now, today, people probably wouldn't even use the word anon. But the sense that most people today get out of that word is, you know, in a short while, I'll get around to it. You know, after a bit, I'll get to it. But in the days of King James, the word anon meant immediately. It has the exact opposite meaning. It means I will jump on it right away. And so even reading the text in English, our own language supposedly, because it has changed so much since the days of King James, that certain times we can be very clearly put out into left field because we don't really understand the language as it was used in his day. So we have these two problems then. The problem of the original language of the Bible not being appropriately translated. The problem that even if it's appropriately translated into King James English, that English itself may have changed between then and now in terms of meaning. And then we have the social and legal customs that we read about in the Bible that are not explained and that we do not fully understand. And sometimes we don't even notice them because we don't understand that our eyes just slide over it. Well, let me give you a few illustrations of that particular instance. For example, Jonah chapter 3. In Jonah chapter 3, we have Jonah finally getting down to the job that was assigned to him, which was, of course, giving Nineveh the message that Nineveh would be destroyed if the people there didn't repent. Finding trouble talking and searching my Bible at the same time, especially in this new one where all the pages seem to stick together. Coming to Jonah chapter 3, verse 5, we read that after Jonah, probably in a very lukewarm way, because he really wanted Nineveh to be destroyed, delivered his warning, you know, God says, you know, his word will not return to him empty. And in this case, the people of Nineveh really responded. It says here in verse 5, the people of Nineveh believed God. And because they believed God, think how remarkable that is. How many times did Israel believe God when a prophet came to them telling them to amend their ways? Or Judah? Not many times. Very few. Here, pagan people did, even though it wasn't their God that was speaking to them. But they believed God, and because they believed God, they proclaimed a fast. Not just a fast for a ritualistic purpose, but to show that they were repenting. Which, of course, is what God wanted them to do. And they put on sackcloth from the greatest of them to the least. The word came to the king of Nineveh, and he arose from his throne and lay aside his robe. He covered himself with sackcloth and sat in ashes. Now, I think most of you are aware of the symbolism of sitting in ashes. It goes along with humiliating yourself, humbling yourself, and as a sign of mourning, and therefore of repentance as well. In this case, mourning over their sins. But notice what it says in verse 7. He caused it to be proclaimed and published throughout Nineveh by the decree of the king and his nobles, saying, "Let neither man nor beast, herd nor flock, taste anything. Do not let them eat or drink water, but let man and beast be covered with sackcloth." Now, some of you have heard me exclaim on this before, but picture it again in your mind. You're in Nineveh at the time when Jonah has declared his message. The people are responding. They're all dressed in sackcloth, and they're sitting in the doorways of their homes in ashes, or in the courtyards of their homes and ashes smeared on their forehead and piled on their head, and dust on their head too. That was part of the routine. Everybody expresses grieving in their own unique way in their culture. But then as you walk through the streets listening to the sound of all this wailing coming from all these homes, you see a cow or a sheep or a goat. And it's lowing or bellowing or whatever goats do. I don't know what word to put to it. I know the sound when I hear it. And it is complaining because nobody has fed it anything and nobody will let it drink any water. And it's hanging on the animal as this nice little sackcloth garment, and ashes are smeared on its forehead. I think we, and from our 20th century perspective, would think this is funny and be tempted to laugh. But obviously the people didn't mean it to be funny. Because it says they believed God, they went at this with a very serious purpose. But yet the Bible doesn't explain why the king's decree included the animals, why the animals had to fast, why the animals couldn't eat, why the animals couldn't drink, why the animals had to wear sackcloth, why the animals had to have ashes on them. The text doesn't stop to explain it. Because in that day and age, nobody would have had to have it explained. It would have been obvious. And the answer is that animals were considered to be full members of the community. And if this is a community-wide fast, every member of the community is expected to participate. And since animals are full members of the community, they, of course, would participate. That's how they would show God how serious they were. So that's one illustration. Another one, if I can find it, because I did not anticipate it, and I hope I can find it. It's in 2 Kings in the early part. Yes, 2 Kings chapter 5. Having to do with Naaman the Syrian. Remember, he was the one who was the commander-in-chief of the armies of the king of Damascus, the king of Syria. And he had an Israelite maid, and he was apparently a good master, and she loved him. Even though she was in servitude to his family, an exile from her people, she had been treated well, and she appreciated that. But he was a leper, and she induced him to go and see the prophet Elisha, believing that Elisha would be able to call on God and heal her master of his leprosy. And we know, of course, that when he finally obeyed the instruction of Elisha to bathe in the River Jordan seven times, that he was healed. And after refusing a gift from Naaman, Naaman makes a request of Elisha. Now again, unless you've had me or someone else exclaim on this point, more than likely, this is something you will say as we read it together now, you never noticed before at all, or you noticed but passed on thinking it didn't mean anything, or if it meant something, you didn't know what it meant. And I'm talking about what's in 2 Kings chapter 5, verse 15. He returned to the man of God, he and all his aides, and he came and stood before him, and he said, "Indeed, now I know there is no God in all the earth except in Israel." Now, he's just made an attestation of faith that the only God in heaven or earth is the God of Israel. But is that what he said? That little prepositional difference makes a lot of difference. Because notice what he says next. It's based on what he's just said, what he says next. He says, "Now therefore, please take a gift from your servant." Of course, Elisha refused it. But then in verse 17, Naaman says, "If not, let your servant be given 2 mule loads of earth. For your servant will no longer offer either burnt offering or sacrifice to other gods except to the Eternal." Why is he asking for 2 mules burden worth of earth? A peculiar request. How many of you have never noticed that before? I was curious. Most of you. How many of you noticed it but just passed on saying, "Well, that's an obscure thing. Who knows what that means?" Anybody? Okay, a few. But you notice that preposition that I made a big thing about? What would you have expected him to say? What would have been the more natural expression back there in verse 15? "I know that there is no God in all the earth except the God of Israel." He says, "in Israel." You see, in those days, people believed that God was localized. He only really had power on his own soil. Now get the connection? He is in Israel where Israel's God has healed him. Why? Because he's in Israel. He's on Israel's soil. Israel's God can answer his prayers. Well, he wants to pray to this God since he's so powerful and the only one really that is a God. But how can he pray to Israel's God when he's back in Syria? Well, if he takes Israelite earth with him back home, he can lay it on the ground, and on that Israelite earth, he can build an altar to the Israelite God, and then everything will work. You see? He's a prisoner of his own culture. And that's why this statement is made. So this gives you some illustrations as to why we sometimes don't get more fully what is written in the Bible because of cultural differences. Now, the second purpose, which falls under the overall purpose I gave you at the beginning, is to shed additional light on those things that are mentioned in the Bible. In other words, the Bible, I like to compare it to a laser beam. It may describe an event or a period of time, but it has a very narrow focus. Just like a laser beam has that quality, that as it goes from the source to its target, it always stays in a narrow beam, never widens out very much. And so the Bible illuminates a certain event, but many times only a small part of that event. And we learn something about that event. But if we're to appreciate more fully the part of the event that the Bible is illuminating, it helps to know more about that event. Then we can understand more fully the part which is illuminated for us in the Bible. And so we will be doing that as well. Now, in accomplishing both of these purposes, we're going to utilize a number of fields of study that are related to history. First of all, geography. That's why you're all taking this geography class, see? One of the things we're going to touch upon is the conflict between the Philistines and Israel. The thing is that geography, and a particular aspect of the geography, rainfall, has a lot to do with why there was conflict between the Philistines and Israel. It's not just they were living side by side. I mean, obviously it's easier to have conflict with the people that you're living next to. But that doesn't mean you have to have conflict. But rainfall, and the way it happens in this area, has a lot to do with why Philistines and Israel came into conflict with each other. A second matter is that this area where Israel was settled by God was invaded by practically every major people of the entire Middle East. Every major people, Egypt, Assyria, Babylonia, Persia, and many other smaller peoples, all of them tried to control the same piece of land where God put Israel. We will only understand why when we take a look at it from the geographical standpoint. We read in the Bible in 1 Kings 9:15, you don't have to turn there now, that Solomon built certain major fortress cities. And it lays great stress on Gezer, Megiddo, and Hazor. Why were those his three major fortress cities, and why not others? When you look at it from the geographical standpoint, it becomes very clear. Why is it that when Jeroboam established his capital, new capital for the northern kingdom of Israel, that he established it at Shechem? Why pick Shechem? From a geographical standpoint, we get a good part of the answer. Okay, that's one field we'll deal with. Two is archaeology. Probably archaeology has contributed more than any other related field to our understanding of biblical history. Let me quote from an article by Harry Orlinsky, a major scholar in the history of ancient Israel, that he wrote in the spring or summer of 1975 in a magazine called Bible and Spade. The destruction of Solomon's temple and the Babylonian exile are two events that we all take for granted. You may wonder what there is about the destruction and the exile that we need archaeology for. Everyone knows about these events. Everyone knows that Solomon's temple was destroyed and a Babylonian captivity followed. So archaeology can play but a relatively minor role here. However, when I started out as a college student in Semitics in the late 20s and 30s, now we're not talking about the 1720s and 1730s, we're talking about the 1920s and 1930s, the destruction and the exile had come to be increasingly regarded by serious scholars as fictitious. As recently as the 1920s and 30s. My teacher at the University of Toronto, Professor Theophile Meek, a person of very considerable knowledge and integrity, used to gloss over this period because he didn't feel entirely secure with the data for it. The evidence for the destruction of Solomon's temple, the evidence for the Babylonian captivity, and the evidence for the return to Judah and its restoration were all rather unsubstantial. Simply because the Bible related these events was hardly enough assurance for a scholar that these events had actually taken place. Just a few decades ago, in the 30s, there developed a group of scholars in this country and in Europe, all outstanding and serious scholars who were writing very bluntly that there never was a significant destruction of Solomon's temple or of Judah as a whole. Consequently, there was no great meaningful captivity, no widespread exile to Babylonia, and therefore there was no restoration of Judah since there was nothing to restore. The whole event was essentially fiction. Now, that's not the opinion of scholars today, no matter how wild they may choose to be. Why? Because archaeology since the 20s and 30s has abundantly proved that there was this captivity and restoration. That's why archaeology is important. It's a very important tool. Later on, we'll address the question, does archaeology prove the Bible, or should we expect it to? But that'll be for a later lecture. But I wanted to show you the influence. I'm just going to quickly cover the other fields of study we're going to touch upon. Comparative literature. Comparative literature shows us how words that are obscure in the biblical text were used by other peoples of the same period. That helps us understand how they should be understood in the Bible, you see, where they occur very infrequently. Comparative literature also gives us idioms, literary devices that were commonly used at the time the biblical books were written. Otherwise, we don't understand their purpose, or we might even make the mistake of thinking they were meant to be taken literally. Because in some cases, it's not literal. I know some people learning English as a second language, they say, I don't understand this business of skinning cats. Why would you want to skin a cat anyway? Well, it's not literal, it's an expression, right? Well, unfortunately, there are the same kinds of expressions in the Bible. But unless we're alerted to them, we don't know that's what they are, that they're expressions. And the last area, comparative religion. Now, this has been used in a wrong way by many scholars, feeling that Israel had nothing original in its religious worship, nothing that was inspired. Therefore, it was always the same as the pagans, you know, in most parts. But it still serves to illustrate certain usages about the pagans that are mentioned in the Bible that are too brief for us to totally understand. It gives us a wider understanding of what those condemnations in the Bible were all about, so we can more fully understand what the pagans were condemned for. Okay, we'll let you go at this point.